Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 26 of NML Crossing, where not only am I reporting from the squeaky chair and the sick room, but, it's the sick house. This weekend's been, it's been kind of sickly. My wife fell ill, and one of our dogs also became sick, so had vet visits, had a lot of tending to, and even a bit of a quarantine situation here at the house. I'm coming to you now with a very, very little sleep. I had to sleep on the couch to avoid getting recontaminated, I guess. And sleep is probably too polite a word for what actually happened. It was just basically tossing and turning until I'd eventually pass out for a few minutes, and then I'd wake up again and toss and turn and then pass out for another few minutes. So it's been a heck of a weekend. I hope you're all well. But today we are going to be kicking off I think the second to last week in the Aftershock era, I believe, if my calendar is correct, and it very seldom is, but I think next Friday, everything goes according to plan, and I'm able to do one of these every day. We should be on the road to No Man's Land next Friday. So this might be right around the midway point of Aftershock, which has been, it's been interesting, I guess. I've enjoyed it, though, as I've mentioned time and again, and I will mention again at the end of this episode, it's damn hard to talk about. There really just isn't much to say. And today's issue will be no different in that regard here. It's a fun one. It's definitely, it feels like it's coming out the wrong end of the 90s. And we'll get into that as we go along here, because we're dealing with a new blood, which I know I wasn't expecting. Anyway, let's get on into it today. We are doing Batman 557, which had an August 1998 cover date. The story is called Ballistics Evidence, written by Doug Mensch, with layouts by Vince Giorano. Finishes Sal Buscema, colors Gregory Wright and Android Images, letters Todd Klein, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill. Cover price $1.95. Now, we open in a warehouse way out in Oakland, California, where Ballistic has just taken a gig. Now, Ballistic, in case you're unaware, and his name and look don't immediately tip you off, he is a Bloodlines character. He first appeared in Batman Annual number 17, and he is a Doug Mensch guy. And he looks like every third Image Comics character circa 1993. That, and also, like, with a dash of Battalion from the Team Titans, who I actually thought this was at first glance. I mean, the early 90s had, very archetypical characters, and this guy definitely lands in one of them. Now, he's a former GCPD officer named Kelvin Mao, and he got the magical alien bite during the Bloodlines event, which made him a meta. Anyway, former cop, current soldier of fortune, Ballistic is taking a gig. He's being hired by a trio of wannabe wise guys to head into Gotham City and retrieve some evidence that's being stored in a valise. That's being stored in a locked safe. That's being stored in the basement of some building that toppled during the very bad thing that happened. Now, they offer him $100,000, half up front, the other half when the job's done. Now, this makes how do we shorten Ballistic here? Because I don't want to say Ballistic 100 times, but I'm probably going to have to. This makes our guy wonder what might be in that valise. And he also makes sure to inform his would-be employers that he is a good guy. You wouldn't know that from the cover, but he is a good guy. He's incorruptible, all that jazz. So, he took the gig, he'll do the job. But the former Gotham City cop in him will force him to follow up with the case just to see where it's going, who's getting it, what's inside, and why they want it so badly. Now this, when you hire a merc or a soldier of fortune, you don't expect to have these sort of follow-up questions, right? So this isn't what the wise guys had in mind. And again, looking at Ballistic and the cover image, which has him fighting with Batman, I wouldn't have pegged him for a good guy either. Now, the wise guys, they decide to pull the offer here. They're like, hey, never mind. Don't worry. We're all good. We never met. But it's too late, because Ballistics already accepted the gig, and no backsies. And so, you know, they do the reasonable thing and open fire on him. But his metaskin is bulletproof. He tells them that they'll be hearing back from him in about a week's time. And they really, really, really don't like the sound of that. They're not pleased. And so they decide to call ahead to their people in Gotham City to let them know that the freak is on his way. Looks like they're going to throw an army at him. We jump ahead to 3 nights later, and we're in Gotham City. Here, a lost National Guardsman is trying to figure out exactly where in Sector G7 he currently is. Unfortunately for him, the bad guy's gunsels are there. And, well, they're not too bright. They think this puny guard is actually Ballistic. And so they open fire. And here we learn that not only are they quite unbright, they've also got, like, the worst aim I've seen this side of G.I. Joe and Cobra. Like, they are literally unloading on this poor geek. And, I mean, they're missing by, you know, a country mile here. They're not doing great. Now, the shots fired, they alert the nearby Batman, who heads over to see what's what. He swoops down to the craterous clearing that the National Guardsman is currently lying prone in, and after a moment of miscommunication, Batman's able to spirit the fella to safety. Well, I guess relative safety. And he tells him to get the F out of there, and so he does. And, I probably ought to mention that the goofballs are still firing. They haven't stopped. I don't know how much ammunition these guys got, but they are nonstop firing. Now, just as they've almost got Batman cornered, they all go ba-woom. You see, Ballistics done blown them all up. Well, sorta. I mean, this is still a mainstream superhero comic, so after the explosion, like, we see them groaning. Just to let us know that they still can, probably. A Ballistic kicks one of them in the face for good measure, and then he calls out to his old pal, Batman. Thing of it is, and there's always a thing to it, our guy has zero idea who this freak is. Now, this is where it gets a little confusing for our Batman here, but not for the loyal readers of the books. Because you see, Bill Ballistic actually has met Batman, but it was during the summer of 1993. So he's down with JPV, not the real deal. Now, Batman kind of just rolls with it. He says he's got, like, so much stress and too little sleep since the quake, and so he's very addled, hence his forgetting of this very forgettable character. They tie up the KO'd gunsels, or the groaning gunsels, while Kelvin explains his current valise situation. While they chat, they get a literal stick of dynamite thrown at them. Like, for real, like a cartoon stick of dynamite, like the bundle of dynamite. It bounces and it lands right at Ballistic's feet, and so he steps on it, like you do. Thankfully, this was the, this turns out to be the right wire to cut. It diffuses the lit stick of dynamite. They then dodge a whole lot more fire before sneaking up behind two teams of gunsels that they thought had them surrounded. We get a page of punchy punchy, and of course the good guys prevail, and they prevail easily. Ballistic then draws his Liefeldian Mark 69 pew-pew gun and just starts shooting it. Like, willy-nilly shooting this damn thing. Batman stops him, giving his disdain for firearms, even against killers. And Ballistic's all, hey, you never mentioned that last time. Turns out, though, Bruce's his worries are for naught here, because Mao ain't trying to shoot anybody. He's actually shooting at what little support some of the wreckage still has, and it sets it free, topples it to the ground, the gunsels drop down, and they're scattered. Now, a gunsel, by the way, is just a criminal with a gun. And yeah, you know, I totally already knew that. I Googled it. Anyway, once the gunsels hit the floor, Ball and Bat punch and kick them many, many times. While Batman's tying up the new crew, Ballistic reveals that he's wearing a belt equipped with two rocket launchers. Two rocket launchers in the belt. Okay. He blasts at the ruins of the building he's supposed to be infiltrating, which opens the place wide open. They enter the wreckage and almost immediately find the valise. It wasn't very well hidden. Actually, it wasn't even hidden anymore, because it was in the cold, dead hands of some dude. Ballistic nabs a key out of the corpse's jacket pocket and takes a peek at the booty. And it's a whole lot of nebulous white powder. And I mean, seriously, Ballistic himself isn't even sure if it's heroin or cocaine. It's kind of a moot point either way, though, as our new blood hurls it skyward and then blasts the bejesus out of it, Youngblood style. A narcotic rain begins to flurry all over the place, which probably can't be good for anybody in the area, right? Or maybe it's really good for people in the area. I don't know. Now, Batman kind of flips out here. He's worried that his temporary partner might have just messed up some, like, big-time DEA case. And Ballistic reminds him that the dudes he took the gig from ain't part of any sort of government enforcement. And he also says that he's going to call this whole thing into Commissioner Gordon so he can look into the dead man who was carrying the case. Mao then invites Batman out to California, and Batman politely turns him down. And, well, they part company, and it turns out they do so right when we run out of pages. And that is where we leave it. Next time out, Detective Comics is back. We skipped issue 723 for the whole Brotherhood of the Fist thing. It's going to be issue 724 next time. And the last time we discussed an issue with the flagship, I think I mentioned that I thought we'd be getting into the letters pages starting this issue. But no, there is a letters page, but there's no Cataclysm content in it. They're still going on about the Ragman two-parter that preceded it. So hopefully, fingers crossed, next time we will get some actual paper letters to discuss here. But speaking of discussing, how about we discuss this one, or try to? Because, there ain't much to talk about, is there? I thought it was fun enough. But it really just felt like a way for Mensch to use his Bloodlines character. It really seems like not that much more thought went into it. Not that there really needed to be. I mean, we're in a sort of nebulous limbo here. We are, we're buying time, you know? Like we've been saying here, how much forethought went into this? Who knows? Maybe they set a plan in motion, they planned a date, and it's like, uh-oh, we got a few months to kill, so how about we bring Ballistic in? Why not? And I mean, if that's the case, it's all well and good. They're trying at least to fill the time. Now, I did appreciate that it was pointed out here that the Batman that Ballistic once chummed up with was John Paul and not Bruce. Because maybe I'm projecting, maybe I'm cynical, but I feel like that's something that would have been completely forgotten during the current era. Like, had this issue came out last week, I don't know that we'd be having the discussion about the different guy in the suit. We'd just be like, oh yeah, we worked together in the past. Sure. You know? And I say that largely because creator runs are so much shorter nowadays. And it would also appear as though very few current year creators bother to read or study what came before them. Or, I mean, even in the case of some families of books, not even bother to read other titles that their characters might be appearing in regularly concurrently, right? So, big thumbs up for remembering that JPV was the Batman during Bloodlines. Which, you know, Bloodlines was a weird time, wasn't it? I mean, we had the reign of the Superman characters in the Superman annuals, and Azbats in the Batman annuals. Was Wonder Woman Artemis at that point? Was Artemis Wonder Woman at that point? And I ask that knowing full well that very few people actually bothered to read Wonder Woman. Then, now, and forever. What else we got? What else we got here? Not much. It was a fun issue. I think I mentioned this earlier, but it definitely felt like something out of the first half of the 90s rather than the last. But I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I feel like you need a little bit of that early 90s cheese, right? At least I do. It's comfort food in a way. And it's something that, you know, we really didn't see much before or after. It was just that weird sweet spot for extremely cheesy comics. And I mean, I might be wrong, because I don't read too many comics now. So maybe there is a groundswell of early 90s, a rebirth of 90s aesthetics coming into play here. I don't know. But as far as I know, that was kind of kept to that particular era. Overall, it was inconsequential but fun. Kind of a pit stop for Ballistic before heading off to the Forgotten Heroes. And by Forgotten Heroes, I mean the actual team named that, not just Limbo, but also Limbo, I guess. He would later be killed by Superboy Prime, along with the rest of the Blood Pack, before being resurrected as a Black Lantern. And it looks like he even got a little bit of representation in the Flashpoint universe. But I feel like a lot of obscure and lol random characters got a little bit of shine during the old toilet flush of 2011. But I think that's all I got to say about the issue. I got actually a little bit more out of it than I thought I would on the back end there. I scripted this thing, or I scripted the synopsis anyway, a few days ago and was struggling to come up with really any sort of unique thought. Unique thought, me. No. I was just worried that there wouldn't be anything to say, so I'm glad we got a little bit of something out of it here, and I also enjoyed my time reading it, so that I think we count that as a win. But before we get out of here, let's hop into our mailbag here, and it's going to be the Batman 556 edition of the mailbag. Here we got three letters discussing that, or tangentially touching upon that. I'm going to start with our friend Chris Yu, and he says, I have to agree with that Wayne Corp suit who said Bruce's money isn't unlimited. I've been wondering just how much it cost Bruce to earthquake-proof all the Wayne properties ever since the New York Magazine article. And while we're on the topic of Wayne money, just what does Wayne Enterprises do? How does Bruce make his money? I've always been perplexed by this question. And it's true. And you know, true to the point where I was actually kind of surprised that it came up in that board meeting in 556. For folks who might not have listened to that episode or forgotten, Bruce is being his aloof philanthropical self. Is philanthropical a word? I don't know. He's a philanthropist, and he's also aloof. So he's kind of disconnected from, I suppose, the fiduciary aspects of his corporations and his holdings and his assets, where it's just like spend. You know, oh, well, these people need money, give it to them. These people need a building, build it. These people need a bridge, put it together. And we have one suit there, the bean counter. I don't remember his name, but maybe we'll see him again. I don't know. But he's one of Wayne's top bean counter counters, and he's just like, hey, you know, there's some, you need a reality check, because not even your funds are limitless. Which, to me, feels like one of those things that maybe you don't want to address in the books, you know, because it is inconvenient, and it does make us start to ask those questions here, like, what do they do? How do they keep making money? Where, how can they keep spending the way they do? And Bruce is still, you know, by far the wealthiest man in the city. How does that work? I guess we saw them doing a fertilizer in that issue of Catwoman, but it's like, what else do they make? What do they do? And how can they keep solvent, especially now? And I don't know, it's just a very interesting question. Just not something you'd figure they'd bring up, because it's going to get us to ask those questions. I remember, you know, reading Mother Panic, for folks who listen to Reggie and me doing the Young Animal segment on the Weird Science Show. The Mother Panic character mentioned something about how Batman always, or Bruce Wayne, always adopts young boys. And it's just one of those things that, like, really stuck out to me, because, yeah, as readers we know that. But when they start asking those questions inside the book, I don't like that. You know? It just seems like it opens too many boxes, right? It opens up suspicion, and then when there's suspicion, there needs to be a logical way to explain it away. And I think, just like this board meeting here, we have this guy talking about the Wayne funds. And it's just like, don't bring that up inside the book, because we're going to start asking those questions. And maybe we'll have to address it. And really, who wants to read that story? Because it doesn't sound entertaining. It doesn't sound fun. It doesn't sound like it'll be a value-added sort of story. But, you know, I do say this from a position of ignorance here. I haven't read any of the Road to No Man's Land yet, so maybe it'll come up again. I know there is a three-parter in Batman that's going to be about Bruce going to Washington. It's the three-part Mr. Wayne Goes to Washington, where I'm guessing he's got to testify and probably try to talk the United States into not blowing up bridges and doing all that mad stuff that they wind up doing. But maybe his vast wealth will come into question there. Maybe there will be a sign that it is running out. You know, maybe it'll be decided that Gotham can't survive on Bruce Wayne alone. I don't know what happens. I don't know the exact reasons why Gotham is rendered into a no man's land, but maybe that'll come up there. Now, following up on this thought, our friend Eric writes in, and he writes in reply to Chris, and he says, "I've been wondering for a long time about what Wayne Enterprises actually is. I know Thomas Wayne is usually referred to as being a surgeon, or having been a surgeon, but then he also owns Wayne Enterprises, and Lucius runs things, but never mentions what it is they actually do, except bid for contracts, donate money, or open new buildings." And yeah, it's true, and I mean, I think we can look at this like in the generation of comic fans, right? I think there was a time, and maybe the time is even now, where you could just be told something and you just kind of accept it. You know, I feel like comics kind of, the pendulum in comic storytelling kind of swings to where we need answers for everything, and then when we just accept things. I don't know if that has to do with the age of like the comics reading cohort, or if it's, I don't know, maybe just something that ebbs and flows. But I mean, you just say, you know, Thomas Wayne was a world-renowned surgeon and became wealthy beyond imagination, and bada bing, bada boom, Wayne Enterprises is a thing. And other times it's like, well, yeah, but what do they make? What do they do? I don't know that we want to see a day in the life of a Wayne Enterprises employee or board member, but I don't know. I think sometimes when we stop to think too much. We just finished watching, we did another watch through of It's Always Sunny the past few weeks. And there's an episode there where Charlie goes to work with Frank. Frank's called back in. Frank is the Danny DeVito character. He's called back in to fix up one of his old companies. And Charlie's asking him, you know, what do we do? And he's like, oh, well, you know, we do this. Well, what do we make? And he goes, we make money. And that was like kind of it. We make money. Of course, that's like a satirical sort of show, so that you can get away with it there. But if someone were to ask Lucius Fox, what does Wayne Enterprises make? And he says, money. I don't know that would necessarily work. But at the end of the day, that kind of just is what it is, isn't it? But I'd like to hear anybody's thoughts on like whether or not we should be thinking so hard on this. Because I go either way. I delve into rabbit holes and get lost in them to the point where I need everything to have the, to use the old Usenet term, internal logic, you know. And other times it's like, okay, I'm okay with just accepting whatever it is they're telling us, and I'll just not think too much. I think for this No Man's Land story to work for all of us, it's going to be challenging, but I think we're going to have to do that thing where we don't ask too many questions, because, I mean, we're going to have a lot of questions. You know, just the United States deciding to designate one of the major metropolitan areas, one of the, you know, financial hubs of the entire country as just, I guess, as a no man's land. It's just insane. And of course, there are those questions like, you know, why didn't the JLA come in? They could have fixed this in three panels. And, you know, those questions that we all want to ask, but won't do us any good to ask. So it's gonna take a little bit to snap us out of our normal sort of comic cynical mindset. And I say that as perhaps the most comic cynical among us. So it's gonna be tough, but we will do our very best. But thanks to Chris and Eric for talking about this, because it is, it's a fun conversation. It's a frustrating conversation, but it's also a very fun one. Next up, we have CJ, who says, congrats on the full month. You should celebrate it. I'm lucky if I release one thing I write a month. A few thoughts on random points made throughout the last month. 1. Batman as urban legend. I like this approach for the first few months in comic time of Batman, but after that it just doesn't make much sense to me. After that point, it feels like someone denying Batman's existence is like a flat earther. They have contradictory evidence for their perspective, but refuse to change their belief. And yeah, this is kind of a sticky thing. To the point where, I think I mentioned this early in the run, maybe in the first episode, but when I was just trying to get my feet wet with DC back in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, I spent a lot of time, again, on Usenet. Sorry to keep bringing that place up, but on places like Usenet and the Alvaro comic boards and stuff, and I kept seeing this Batman is not real, you know, and I thought, there's no way that can work. You know, it just sounds, it sounds insane, right? Just like CJ says here, it's like a flat earther, or I mean, in these books, they're like, yeah, that's as likely as an alien landing. It's like, you live in the DC universe, dude. I mean, they're everywhere. It's weird, the sort of disconnect between the Bat books and the rest of the DC universe, despite the fact that Batman is a very active member of the overall DC universe. I mean, he's in the JLA. It's very bizarre. And it's one of those things, like we've been talking about, we've just got to kind of accept it. You know, it sounds silly. And the fact that, I mean, this isn't like Bigfoot. You know, this is a whole lot of people living in a city who all have eyewitness accounts of this character, including all the bad guys. I mean, the bad guys know he exists. And still, it's the urban legend thing holds on. I don't remember if or when it goes away, or if it's just something that's phased out. Like, I don't know if there's like, okay, yeah, here's a press conference. Batman's real. Here he is. He's going to say a few words. I don't know if that actually happens, but I don't know. I'm thinking it probably just phases out, but I could be wrong. Chris continues. 2, the trend in current comics for the end of events to be just the beginning of another event. Very annoying, and part of the reason why I don't read events nearly as much as I used to. And the ones I do read now, I only read the core event instead of the spin-off titles. While some of this trend owes a debt to regular series cliffhangers and serialized storytelling overall, event comics are designed to be different and bring readers into series they might not have done, and I think the incomplete story events after betrays on that promise. Yes, there should be some things planted for the shared universe to pick up later on, but the event should still be complete and relatively self-contained. You guys know I love the word relatively. I say that a lot, but I agree 100%. I really, really do, because the trend is to go from event to event to event. The ongoing series are treated as... they're not even treated as ongoing series anymore. They're basically mini-series to get us to and from events. And unfortunately, I mean, they're not doing this for their health. I mean, I guess the industry is doing it for their health. They're not doing it just to be jerks. They're doing it because it works. Hey, that rhymes. I mean, if we weren't buying these events, they'd probably have to go back to the drawing board and think up a new tack. But they do. They do sell. And unfortunately, the current trend of crossovers and events started with, in my opinion, a really bad story. Or maybe a good story that just didn't fit, and that was with Civil War. And sure, the year before that, there was House of M, but that didn't have nearly the sort of impact overall on the industry as Civil War did. And from then, we haven't had a break. And that was, what, 2005? So we're going on 20 years of almost constant crossover and event. And even the fact that we say we've got fatigue, well, when we don't vote with our wallets, the industry does not care, you know, and they shouldn't. And they shouldn't, because it is a business. As much as I hate to admit it, you know, they're not doing this to wow us with stories. They're doing this to sell books. And damn it, those events sell. And damn it, when you can end an event on a cliffhanger that's going to be followed up in the next event that's starting next week, well, they're going to do it. I mean, when we were doing X-Lapsed early on, like, there were times where a book would have the banner of two different events on the same cover. There was an X of Swords one, or X of Tens, we used to call it, and what was it? Empire? Was it Empire? The stupid plant thing? I think it was Empire. Yeah, it was Empire and X of Tens were branding on the same cover. It's like, we're doing two crossovers in the same book? What? Why? How? How and why? And, I mean, it all comes down to the bean counters, right? And while nowadays that's the rule, not the exception, we're actually going to have an issue like that during NML Crossing. There's an issue of Azrael that has a Day of Judgment branding and No Man's Land branding on it. So, I mean, I guess No Man's Land is more of a branding for the year, but I don't know, we've got two events being represented in the same book, and that kind of shouts poor planning to me. Back to CJ, he says, 3, why other superheroes don't help Gotham? I don't know if there's a good reason given for this, or if there could be one that would make sense, especially to those Usenet members. But it certainly is a better story for not having other DC heroes offering easy solutions. Also, I feel like so many comic stories could be solved by having other, more powerful heroes in the universe guest star, but that would rob us of a lot of good stories focusing on solo heroes and or autonomous teams. I don't think the more powerful heroes not helping out makes sense in-universe, but in the context of a good story, I'm fine with Gotham and Batbooks being generally separate from the rest of the DC universe at this point. And it's true. It's true. That is going to be one of those things I'm going to have to, like, put, like, a quarter jar on my desk here. So, because every time I mention the JLA should be here, I should just throw a quarter in there. Because, I mean, it's not going to happen. And it shouldn't happen for the benefit of the story. There will be an issue of JLA we're going to cover. There is an issue that does tie in. It's not even branded as No Man's Land, but it is on all the reading lists and all the, you know, the triptychs through No Man's Land. So we will be addressing something. I just don't know what yet. And I do know from my reading of the abridged collections that Superman does show up and offer to help, and Batman basically tells him to hit the bricks. I don't know how much sense it makes for Superman to listen to him and do that, but I mean, we'll talk about that, I guess, as we get there. But I'm totally on the same page as CJ here. The heroes, no matter how much internal logic there is saying that the JLA shows up, they snap their fingers and everything's good, but then we wouldn't have a story, and in fact we probably wouldn't have any stories. You know, when we start thinking too hard, like what was that Amazing Spider-Man issue with 9/11 in it, you know, and like we had all these heroes and villains like standing there crying, and then you think, like, we're in a universe that has Thor, we're in a universe that has, you know, the entire Avengers, and how do these things happen? You know, it's like you can't think too hard about it, because it's just going to drive you insane, or it's going to make you actively and aggressively hate comics. It's one thing comic fans, we get a lot of flack from the pros and from people outside the fandom for being persnickety, you know, to put it nicely. We want everything to make sense. We want every question answered. But at the same time, it's like we still want it to be, we want comics to be a place where we can escape. You know, we want the escapism, but we also want reality at the same time. And I mean, we get a lot of flack from the pros for things that we shouldn't be held accountable for. But this sort of one foot in, one foot out, they kind of got us dead to rights here. We want too much. We want everything. It's And it's just that dissonance we have inside us, I guess. You know, I don't know if it's a matter of wanting to make comics seem a little bit more, I guess, literate, less kid stuff, more reality based. I don't know, but yeah, we want it both ways, and unfortunately, that just can't happen. Back to CJ. He says, number four, the rose-colored glasses, the trap for all of us nostalgic types. I try to keep this in mind when griping about current anything, which isn't to say that change hasn't happened and has had no effects, but it's to try to keep a more realistic and cool head about things, and has made it easier for me to enjoy current comics. Connected to this, I just think superhero comics will never be as good to me as they were when I was 6 to 20 years old. Not even because of any change in comics quality or production, but just because superheroes appeal to the childish part of us. This isn't to say that superhero comics can't be for adults. I clearly read and think about superhero comics a lot as an almost 40-year-old. But I think there are times in our lives where certain things will hit us harder than other times. And I totally agree with that as well. There's an old chestnut, your whatever you like will never be as good as it was when you were 12. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think 12 years old is where, where hobbies can become obsessions, you know. It's like you're growing out of the more cliche childish stuff, perhaps. Or maybe you're just maturing with your hobby. You know, maybe I'm talking on my ass, I don't know. But when I was 12 years old, it was 1992. Which was a huge year for comics. A year, I don't know if we had a year like that since. You know, Image launched, the death of Superman, the X-Men were just like going nuts. It was a really, really special time in the fandom and in the industry. So it's like, yeah, I get that. And it's never going to be like that again. They've tried doing like pastiches of, I mean, they did X-Men 92 and that was garbage. That like actually made me angry. It was so bad. And X-Men 97, forget about it. I couldn't deal with it. I thought it was terrible. And I know like DC did a bunch of like 90s variant covers, but it was basically like taking the piss. It was like, oh, Superman with a mullet. He's got a blow dryer fixing his hair. It's like, that's really what we distill the 90s down to? I don't know. It's very seldom when I see anything from the 90s being treated with even a little bit of respect. And, you know, there actually is a book that started, I think, a year ago that I'm still collecting and reading. Believe it or not, I'm actually reading a current year book, and it's not from Marvel or DC. It's a book by Tim Seeley and, who's the other guy? Fleeks? It's a book called Local Man. It's through Image, and it's about a hero from like the dawn of the Image universe who retired and he's back, and there's a lot of callbacks to those early days, but it's not treated as a parody. It's treated with respect, like this is something that happened in this world. The characters were like this, and that's just the way it was. It treats it with, like I said, it treats it with respect. It doesn't talk down to the reader. It doesn't have an air of look how silly this all was, and look at how silly you all were for reading it. It's actually very well done, and I'd recommend it to anybody who was around during that time or would like a less look at, you know, a retrospective on what comics were like back then. I mean, they're tying into, like, Deathmate. There's references to Wildstorm characters, because the Wildstorm characters were Image characters first. Now that they're DC, it's, you know, different, but there's actually callbacks to Wildcats in an Image book that came out in 2023. It's a lot of fun. And again, if you haven't started reading Local Man, I would recommend it. I think it's only up to like issue 9, so it shouldn't be too difficult to track down. I'm sure it's available digitally on the Image website or whatever they have for digital comics, but I'd say it's definitely worth a look. It's a flip book. And like one side, it's like the current year story. You flip it over and it's something out of the 90s. So you get like the backstory of what this character experienced back in the dawning of the Image universe. And a lot of it plays forward in the current year story. So very big recommendation for Local Mana. I'm not being paid to say that, but it's a good one. I actually was turned on to it by my buddy Walt, who was checking it out. And I ran out that day, and I picked up, I think it was the first three issues, because that's where it was up to, and just got lost in it. I was expecting one thing, and they zigged instead of zagged, and I was very, very pleased with what we got there. Anyway, with that out of the way, back to CJ. Number five, regarding the lack of forethought. We have definitely seen that comic publishers don't always seem to have long-term plans or detailed long-term plans. To avoid those rose-colored glasses, it definitely happened when we were kids, as you've said a few times over the NML series. Before I started writing my own comics, I do know I used to underestimate how much time and how much hard work going into one comic series can be, let alone a shared universe or corner of the universe. And I wasn't on a monthly schedule, so monthly schedules would make that even harder. This normal burden that I think has been exacerbated by the corporate mindset taking over, a mindset that focuses more on maximizing quarterly revenue than long-term growth. Although that could be seen as a shallow interpretation of the best corporate approach, one may be practiced by corporations run poorer than they could be. I think the best corporations balance those two goals with slightly more emphasis on long-term growth. And yeah, you know, I totally agree there. And I'd forgotten that you actually create stuff, CJ. I forgot that you'd mentioned that before, and I had totally forgotten it. But I think you're on the money here with the short-term approach being used by the at least mainstream comics. They're not so worried about long-term. I mean, every year there's rumors that DC and or Marvel are going to reboot. Every single year. I mean, just a few weeks ago, something was going around that DC is going to do a New 52-esque reboot in the fall. And it's like, why? You know? Just so you can beat Marvel for 2 months? Because that's all it's going to be. They're going to beat Marvel that first month, maybe the second. But then people are going to stop caring. They're going to realize, oh, okay, well, this is just the way it is now. All the, you know, all the shocks, surprises, and all the awe is going to be gone. Because New 52, the bloom came off the rose very quickly. Very, very quickly. It was 1 month, maybe two, that they beat Marvel. And, like, they celebrated, you know. That was, a big throw-the-hat-in-the-air moment. But at what cost? You know, because the New 52, I call it the toilet flush, but it was like a non-ending toilet flush until Rebirth. I think DC was shedding readers. All the books, except for like Batman and Justice League, were just dipping in the charts. People just stopped buying them after a little while because attrition just happens in this sort of a serialized, periodical sort of medium. I mean, even podcasting, I don't charge anybody a penny to listen to this stuff, but anytime I put out something with an episode one, it's going to get more listens. It's going to get more downloads, and that's going to trickle down until it gets to what it's going to be. You know, people are curious. People want to know what's what, and, you know, they might decide it isn't for them, or they might just forget about it, or it might just be like, I got other stuff to listen to, and that's just part of the deal. And it's there as a creator, you have to decide what you want out of your creation. You know, and this is just a silly show where I talk out my ass for a half hour a day. But, you know, is it going to be a resource? Maybe. Is it going to be something that people can find somewhere down the line and maybe enjoy a story that they didn't follow the first time? Or am I going to stop and start another thing with a new number one? So for the first week or so, instead of getting 60 downloads, I get 110. You know, that's the mindset in the industry right now, too, which really sucks for those of us who are loyal and have been loyal and actually care about the industry still being a thing in the next, you know, decade or two. Like, we don't want these things to go away, but at the rate it's going, the folks in the industry seem all too happy to shake us, you know, old timers off, you know, us loyalists. They're cool shaking us off if they can get the young people to buy for even just 1 month. And again, I totally forgot that CJ actually creates something. The pursuit of creativity and just making something new was something that lent a great deal to my recent near self-destruction over the past couple of years. I had that fire in my belly. You know, I wanted to make something, not a show, because what I'm doing now is I'm talking about the work of other people. You know, that's all a blog or a podcast is to me. It's talking about the wonderful and not so wonderful things that other people made. It's kind of a way, it's a band-aid to me. It's like, it's a way I could trick myself into thinking I'm making something, you know, when I'm really just adding to a litany of voices that are critical or supportive of someone else's work. The past few years, I mean, I could go into depth here. I could talk about it for hours, but, this probably isn't the right venue for that. Suffice it to say, I respect anybody who puts work out, who has the guts to do that. Even if, like you said, you might not even do one thing a month, but the fact that you do anything at all is huge. And I envy that. It takes a special sort of person to actually pick something, you know, out in the distance. You have this dream, you know, you have this thing you want to make happen. And if it takes you a day or if it takes you a year, you do it. And that's just not me, unfortunately. I had some real come to whoever you find holy moments the past couple of years where, yeah, you start to realize I'm a little bit older than you are. I'm in my early mid 40s. And you start to realize that, you know, you never want to say you're too old to do something, but it's less time to do it. For sure. But before I spiral any further, and I could on this subject, I'll just thank CJ for his message, and I'll try to remember to link to your work in the show notes today. I fingers crossed I don't forget, but I will do my best to remember that. CJ does wrap up by apologizing for the long post, but again, never apologize for sharing long thoughts here. I love these kind of conversations. They take us in very weird directions sometimes, and it almost did today, but I was able to pump the brakes for the benefit of everybody, probably myself especially. But, my friends, I think that's where we'll put a pin in it for today. If anybody would like to join in on the conversation, I encourage you to do so. You could find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, Facebook, Twitter, yada, 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 yada. But with my masterful plugs out of the way, I'll just thank you all so much for choosing to spend some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, talk to you again real soon. See ya. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist.